.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Last week we went back some 18 years to listen to Cage Baker, and we're going to one-up that by going all the way to 1993 to hear Pat Cadigan read a wonderful story for us. But as is usual on this program, we begin with Dan Persson's segment on genre cinema. Stay tuned.
Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review, except no substitutes. The new romantic fantasy, A Ghost Waits, which will be available on demand and on Blu-ray this very Tuesday, has quite a few things going for it. It's about a ghost, Muriel, played by Natalie Walker, who's haunting a pretty damn nice suburban home, and how she forms a romantic relationship with Jack, played by McLeod Andrews, who also co-scripted, who's the guy sent to clean up the joint after Muriel has scared away its most recent tenants. The film has a relaxed, quasi-mumblecore vibe in its telling. Jack is a 30-something stuck in a dead-end corner of the gig economy, while Muriel has to contend with the low-rent bureaucracy of the afterlife and an enthusiastic newbie, played by Sidney Vollmer, seeking to replace her. Director and co-writer Adam Stovall, making his feature film debut, makes the most of what was probably an insanely limited budget, suggesting all the supernatural goings-on through the use of creative lighting, some editing tricks, and the nooks and crannies of what I'm presuming was whatever house was available for a film crew working on a shoestring budget. And Walker and Andrews both deliver appealing comedy performances, and I would say that they also make a good on-screen couple, and they almost do. But one of the flaws of A Ghost Waits, aside from the fact that the title is nonsense, A Ghost Waits for What?, is that co-writers Stovall and Andrews skip over some necessary storytelling in showing how these two characters go from adversaries to kinda sorta lovers, as much as a mortal and a ghost can be lovers. Instead of dramatically building up their interplay to show the transition, Stovall settles for showing the two talking to each other in a dialogue-free montage, asking us to take on faith that there's a meeting of minds and a joining of hearts. That same glossing over of the tale's emotional stakes also derails the finale, where the failure to satisfactorily establish Jack's life undercuts the actions he takes at the film's end, which I will only spoil to the extent that I guessed early on how the film would end up. I know what they were going for because, frankly, other films have used the same gambit, but here, it doesn't feel earned, and given what the finale is, the film desperately needed that. Still, A Ghost Waits is clever and fun and pretty charming. Not a romance for the ages, but an entertaining experience overall. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. Good Beltane and happy May Day, everybody. This is a holiday which dates back to at least the times of the Roman Republic and probably predates that with ties to pagan celebrations. Think maypoles, if nothing else. Emotionally, this has been a difficult week. If you haven't heard, Bob Fast passed away last week, and WBAI will not be the same without him. His spontaneous style, his sense of radio and community helped put WBAI on the map since the early 60s. There's little that I can say other than to advise you to go to the WBAI website and follow the link to the special mix that Peter Beauchamp has gifted us with. Or go to Netflix and watch the documentary about Bob, fittingly called Radio Unnameable. May 1st is also the date that I choose to celebrate my first coming to WBAI in 1967 at the age of 13. I'd come to the station largely at the urging of my uncle to answer phones. It was heady and exciting. And the biggest thrill for me as a WBAI fanboy was seeing first Steve Post and later next week Bob Fass live on the air. This is also about the time that I met up with Baird Searles, our drama and literature department director, working with such illustrious names from the science fiction world as Samuel R. Delaney, Joanna Russ, Theodore Sturgeon, and Thomas M. Dish. So if or when I have a program on any May 1st, I get nostalgic with joy and sadness as the years go by, and with the passing of Bob Fass, it is all that much sadder. Although he had a long life and did so much for so many hundreds of thousands of people, literally, if not more. But the bottom line is that mortality sucks. So it is with such memories that I must urge you to make sure that this listener-sponsored radio station, without the likes of which neither Bob Fass or I or many, many people could make a meaningful contribution to a medium that is considered yet another fabulous invalid. That is a phrase that is usually applied to theater, which is going to come back, or short stories, which never went away. But people haven't even decried the death of radio since David Sarnoff proclaimed it dead in the early 60s, given the advent of television. But for now, we're still here. But we will only be here if you are there, supporting us. So I'm going to take this opportunity to remind you all that what we do at WBAI is a collaboration with you. You are our sponsors. That is why I am asking you to make a financial pledge to us right now by calling area code 212-209-2950 and pledge a minimum of $25 so that you too will be a full listener sponsor again. That's 212-209-2950. The best thing for us is if you choose to become a WBAI buddy, which is sort of like a Patreon pledge in which you give a certain amount every month. If you're too sleepy to make a phone call right now, you can do this anytime online at give2wbai.org. That 2 is the number 2, give2wbai.org. So here's a little dialing music from Steel Eye Span. And then it's on to Pat Cadigan. Cadigan should be celebrated far more than she is. When people think about who some of the writers were that pioneered cyberpunk, they think of William Gibson or Bruce Sterling. But I'm here to tell you that Pat was right alongside them from the start. Today's story sort of goes the other way, though, and is the first of two shows that we're going to have in the next couple of months that relate to the best-known works of J.M. Barrie. The other will be at our reading series in June featuring Allison C. Wise, A.C. Wise, reading from her new novel, Wendy, Darling. But this story, The Lost Girls, has been a favorite on Hour of the Wolf through the years, and it's been a long time since it has been broadcast. It seems particularly appropriate on a date when I just need to be one of them lost children who won't grow up. So, set your Wayback Machine to 1993 to Dixon Place and the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and join us. But first, some music from the amazing Broadway show from Mabu Mines, Peter and Wendy.
All children, they will grow up. They always know after they're two. Two is the beginning of the end.
This next one that I'm going to read to you is called Lost Girls, and it's going to be the original story in my upcoming collection, Dirty Work, Lost Girls. Well, I tried to tell him there was going to be trouble. I really did. I really thought that as the female who'd been closest to him the longest, I'd have some major influence, that he would listen. But it's the same old story. It's just about impossible to get anyone to take you seriously when you're only a few inches high and covered with fairy dust. And you're cursed with tinkling bells for a voice. After that, the frivolous name is practically an anticlimax. Can't say I haven't contributed to my own predicament, though. For time out of mind, I played the role of the party girl with gusto. I mean, after all, I was the one who always got everybody high. Literally. You wanted to fly, I was the girl to see. I had the stuff. Still am. You can't help what you are, after all. But, as I maintained to Peter, you can help what you do with it. We're doing just fine, Tink, he said, folding his arms behind his head and watching the clouds sail by. He was picking out shapes in them, ships, castles, dragons, two-headed teddy bears, the usual for around here. The clouds always do that, float across the sky in shapes you could pick out, except on the few occasions that call for a corker of a thunderstorm. We're doing better than ever. We're giving all those boys and girls a childhood. Childhood's getting scarcer all the time. They have to start school now when they're practically out of their prams. They don't even have prams anymore, not the way we used to know them. And by the time I come to take them away on adventures, they can read and count and write. They can name the days of the week and the months of the year, and their heads are filled with the most peculiar notions. For instance, he said quickly, sitting up and letting a really good cloud that looked like a giant porcupine playing a pipe organ break up unnamed. For instance, that little one that kept trying to tell me the Indians weren't Indians. They were... He made a face. Couldn't remember, of course. Peter's memory is the size of a hazelnut, and not a very big hazelnut. But then, it has to be. He wouldn't be who and what he is if he had any kind of memory. He's the original lost boy, after all. And so he's perpetually at square one. Every hurt is like the first hurt, every joy like the first, and so on and so forth. But when the occasion called for it, he could summon up a little recollection about something extraordinarily bad, or extraordinarily good, or just extraordinarily extraordinary. This would stay with him for a little while until some other extraordinary thing came along to replace it. Native Americans, I said. I always remember. Being a fairy, my memory is not subject to the constraints of eternal childhood. Who are, he said. Indians, Peter. Indians. The little boy told you that Indians should really be called Native Americans. I wasn't impatient, just bored. Oh, yes. Native Americans. Indians. Heavens, Tink, what are Americans? The Indians are the Indians. They've always been the Indians. No use to explain to Peter about that, that the people he called Indians bore about as much resemblance to the real thing as I did. Some of them could have been Sioux or Comanche or Mohawk, but the rest of them were a mixture of nationalities and ethnic groups. Peter had a child's blindness to that kind of difference between people, endearing and beautiful in one way, totally insensitive in another. Gay, innocent, and heartless, remember? Tiger Lily and I had covered that subject a few times in the course of our many late-night talks. When Peter thought I was safely shut up in my little house within the house, I would fly off into the night over the mountains and the valleys and the lagoon to her teepee. She was the only other female on the island who would understand. Yes, we set aside our differences a long, long time ago, though Peter doesn't know it. As the source of the problem, he just wouldn't get it. He'd feel betrayed, even though he never understood why we were in conflict in the first place, and never will. How's that for an obtuse male, I ask you? He's a child, Lil said, rolling her eyes. The idea that there'd be something about people that had nothing to do with him or his ideas just never occurs to him. If you try to tell him even just a little bit about what really happened to the people called Indians, well, it'd be like speaking high church Latin to him. He'd understand it about as well. He's got just enough information and misinformation in more or less equal parts to offend anyone except a very young child. That would have to be a very, very young child, I reminded her. But mostly what we discussed was what we called the female predicament. All sorts of children came to the island with Peter, children of every culture, every color, every faith. The only difference Peter ever recognized was gender. Boy, if you'll pardon the expression. Tiger Lily and I laid most of the blame squarely on Wendy. Perhaps that's not really fair, but she did start the whole mother business. I knew she was trouble. The second I laid eyes on her in the nursery that night, the second Peter laid eyes on her, forgot his shadow right. What galls me is that I didn't see through that one immediately. But after all, I'm a fairy. We handle things differently. It's all magic with us. I should have known, though. I'd been around Peter long enough, and even if he had lived in Never Neverland since falling out of his pram in Kensington Gardens, he'd always be more human boy when it came right down to it. Which suggests, naturally, that even he wasn't really aware of what he was doing when he forgot his stupid shadow and then had to go back for it. But with all the signs there, I should have been able to read them. I shouldn't have had to have gotten locked in a damn drawer before I figured out what was going on. Was I mad when he let me out? And was she surprised when she saw me? Tried to kiss up to me right away, too. Talking about how beautiful I was and acting all enchanted to see a real live fairy and all that rot. But the look in her eyes wasn't wide, innocent wonder. Her eyes weren't quite wide enough. In fact, they were narrowed ever so slightly. It wasn't wonder there, but wariness and territoriality and jealousy. Jealous of a fairy only a few inches high? Talk about mixing information and misinformation. Right away, she started trying to one-up me. Oh, I can sew, and I can do the spring cleaning, and I'll be your mother, and blah, blah, blah. And I got sucked right into it. I can't deny that. I get pissy about the fairy dust. Okay, shame on me. But in the end, they flew, all of them, they flew away to Never Neverland, had all those adventures. Okay. The thing with the arrow was awful, too. But come on, this is Never Neverland we're talking about. I knew she couldn't actually be killed. Not killed, not killed dead. It's like a roller coaster, a great scare, but nothing permanent. I wanted to scare the living daylights out of her. I wanted to scare her so bad she could fly all the way back to the nursery just by screaming. Now I shudder to think that I could do such a thing to another female, even if it was Wendy. Do you see how crazy it made me? And in such a short period of time. Awful, just awful. But she played it for all it was worth and then some. Her great hovering on the brink of death scene. Name me someone else who got a whole house built for herself that way. So it wasn't much of a house. We all continued to live in the underground place. The symbolism was enough to seal our fates. By attacking her, I'd managed to cement her position. She had second thoughts about it after a while, when it was too late really to do anything about it. If she hadn't started the whole mother business, she'd have been treated like a lost boy with a dirty face and her own bow and arrow. She wasn't the first girl who'd made it to Never Never Land, but there hadn't been many in the past. Peter automatically gravitated to boys, though occasionally one or two of them had sisters who came along, as if caught in the backwash. Canny little things, kept a low profile, did everything the boys did, okay, obeyed Peter's orders and didn't say much. I checked on them later, and I must say it was interesting the way things turned out for them. The little Sanger girl, for instance. Looking at it from that angle, you would think that the first female to assert herself as a female rather than just one of the boys could have brought some significant changes to Never Never Land, and thence to the world. But as soon as we get one, what does she do but perpetuate the same old roles? Well, it was all she knew. Being female has never saved anyone from a limited imagination. But perhaps it might have been different if she'd been a single parent and not insisted that Peter be the father. That would have made the position of mother something altogether different. She might have come into her own as a heroic figure. But that was part of all she knew, mother and father, and from her point of view, Peter was the logical choice for father, even leaving the way she felt about him out of it. And when you consider her emotions, well, there was no one on the island to advise her that just because you love a male doesn't mean that you should have a family with him. Would she have listened if there had been? To be fair, I don't suppose I'd have wanted to be the single mother of that bunch either. But with Peter as the father, she might as well have been. Peter, the father with the roving eye, and dumb enough to talk to Wendy about it. Gosh, Wendy, I don't know what Tiger Lily wants to be to me, but I don't think it's a mother. Ooh, did she give him hell about that? And poor Lil, she got sucked into the game just as I did. Peter and the boys rescued her from the pirates hundreds and hundreds of times. It was part of the great tradition that makes Never Never Land what it is. It wasn't that Peter nearly died on the rock. He always nearly died. Hooks bite the rising tide, Peter speaking what he believes will be his last words about dying being an awfully big adventure. This is fantasy childhood drama. She changed everything. I saw it at the celebration at the Indian camp later, the way she looked at Lil. It was the same way she'd looked at me in the nursery. Lil obviously didn't know it was happening exactly, but she reacted to Wendy the way she would have to anyone hunting on Indian land without permission. And she knew instinctively that she had to win something of Peter's heart if she ever wanted to be rescued from the pirates again. I think that was the bitterest pill for her. Up until then, winning something of Peter's heart wasn't even an issue. If Peter had even just been showing signs of growing up, impossible, of course, but just for the sake of example, she'd have let him go. But that wasn't the problem. In my more unkind moments, I've thought that was why Wendy got herself captured by the pirates. Of course, everybody got captured by the pirates. That was part of the tradition. But this time, it wasn't just Hook and his men capturing all of Peter's men. This time, Hook had Peter's family, the children, and their mother. It put a whole different spin on the rescue, especially after that little scene she played with the boys in the underground house. Another blatant attempt to force Peter's hand is what it was, telling him that story about mothers pining away for their children, reminding the boys. Not the first time she told the story. I knew sooner or later Peter would listen to it, and it would get to him. Did she really, truly believe, deep down, that she would be able to pull Peter away from Never Never Land? If so, the joke was on her. She got everyone except Peter. And the looks on those boys' faces as they prepared to leave Never Never Land forever. Is it any wonder I tried to kill myself? I know, everyone thinks it's my noblest moment, saving Peter from drinking Hook's poison. But I didn't have to drink it myself to do that. Every other time, I always just flew into the room and knocked the glass from his hands. But that time, I was in despair. I felt Peter's loss even more deeply than he did. I loved those boys, too, after all. They were a big part of my life as well. The way she manipulated their feelings, playing them like blooming violins, for goodness sake. What a nightmare. I felt that was worse poison than what Hook put in Peter's medicine, another of Wendy's little innovations, as if anyone ever got sick on the island. So I squared my shoulders, preened my wings, and said, "Goodbye, cruel world." Yes, I really would have died, sort of. As Peter has explained to countless children, real death comes for one of my kind whenever a child says, "I don't believe in fairies." The poison would have killed me as well, just because of the treatment Peter had decided on, leaving it to children everywhere all over the world to affirm their belief in fairies. Had I expired before Peter could help me, I would simply have been reborn in some other realm that allows the existence of fairies without memory, without sadness. I was hoping for something Nordic. And then Peter had to interfere. Had his treatment failed, had there been too few children clapping their hands, there would have been no rebirth for me, just nothingness. Peter felt he had to prove something to both of us, that he still had it, of course, that he was still the most beloved boy of all time, and thus children would clap their hands just because he asked them to. Some see that as Peter's noblest moment. Others see it as childhood's noblest moment. The truth is something that is probably best left unsaid in a place like Never Never Land. You can't have a Never Never Land without a certain amount of denial. You know the rest of the story. Did Hook and the pirates really die? Of course not. I found Hook later, washed up on the shore of Mermaid Lagoon with his clothes in rags, cursing a blue streak. Most of it sounded like, "Arr, arr," and vowing revenge. If a little confused, he thought he'd lost his hand to the crocodile just then. I kept an eye on him until Smee floated in, clinging to a bit of driftwood. If it were not against the rules, I would visit Smee in the middle of the night sometimes and have a few long talks with him, too. I suspect there's a lot of common ground between us, and perhaps the time is coming when I will be able to have a word or two with him. Everyone weeps over the last meeting between Wendy and Peter in London, myself included. Surprised? Me too. A little. Of course, I don't just weep over that. I weep for the lost boys, become bankers and citizens of good standing. How I miss them, Toodles and Slightly and the rest. And I weep for Wendy, too, for a realization of what she lost, which was not Peter. What she lost was much more complex than that. And then she went and did it anyway, let her own daughter take her place to do Peter's spring cleaning. Oh, that really galled me. I just thought that growing up would have made her realize her mistake, and instead she visited it upon her daughter, and her daughter did the same to her daughter, Wendy's granddaughter. Except by then, things were starting to change. There's a whole new group of lost boys in Never Never Land, of course, and Peter's memory didn't admit that there'd ever been any others, though occasionally he slipped and called one of them Toodles and was mightily confused at his mistake since he didn't remember Toodles. The name just came out of nowhere as far as he was concerned. I never reminded him. He never slept with the girls. There would be only one Wendy, and though her memory grew dim, it never vanished completely. Odd, but there's no accounting for the vagaries of a mind like Peter's. What was even more interesting, though, was that from the time Wendy left, there was never more than one girl brought to Never Neverland, and she was always brought to fill Wendy's old position as quasi-mother. No more did little girls slip in among the gang, brought to have adventures with the pirates and the Indians, and to vow that they would never grow up, at least for a little while. There was always just the one girl. Wendy's daughter went along with it, but Wendy's granddaughter, she was a different story altogether. She wasn't completely free of the expectations that had been thrust upon her, both here in Never Neverland and back in the real world, but she questioned a lot, and if she didn't like the answers, she could be quite stubborn. One day, I found Peter and the boys making their own beds. She was off swimming in Mermaid Lagoon. Hook tried to capture her, of course, and Peter and the other boys ran to her rescue. But what do you suppose they found when they got there? Hook, running as if for his life, while she pelted him with stones and shells and driftwood and anything else she could find to throw, and yelling threats of worse punishment if he ever had the nerve to bother her again. Poor Hook. He didn't know what hit him. After all, he was a pirate. When he captured her and the boys later, his pirate band was twice the size it usually was, and to this day, I have no idea where he found the extra men. Men, yes. As I said, he was a pirate. So, after they all went home to grow up, I tried to talk to Peter. Next season, I said, just round up a bunch of boys and girls and treat them all like lost boys. The whole point is to have adventures without parents, especially mothers. They're all like that. If spring cleaning doesn't get done and the beds don't get made, so what? This is Never Neverland, for heaven's sake. But would he listen? Lost boys and a mother. That was the formula, he said. He was Peter Pan. I was just the fairy with the dust. My job was to get them off the ground. He was the one who really taught them how to fly, and he was the leader. Then he reminded me about saving my life the time I drank poison, and believe me, I bit my tongue pretty hard to keep from telling him a few hard truths about that. But then I'm pretty sure it's against the rules to use the word suicide attempt in Never Neverland. Certain amount of denial, right? So he went and he got Wendy's great-granddaughter, and that's when the dirt really hit the fan. Only Hook is allowed profanity, and he never gets worse than damn. I got away with ass just because it really is another word for donkey. Wendy's great-granddaughter got the picture the minute her feet touched down on the island. Ooh, you never saw such a fuss. Mother, I'll give you mother. I didn't fly straight on till morning to clean up after a bunch of boys. Now bring on those pirates. Where's that Hook? I'll tear him limb from limb. Where are the Indians? I want to beat the tom-tom and go on the warpath. Where's the ferry? I want to fly some more. Peter, of course, tried to argue with her. From the moment he alighted at her window to the time they took off into the night, he never once said spring cleaning or mother or anything like it. By then, he was taking a lot for granted. He shouldn't have been. You know that. I know that. I think even some of the long-term boys knew that. But Peter, well, that's the perennial boy for you. Things had changed back there in the world. It didn't mean there had to be any kind of major changes in Never Neverland except for the genders of the children involved. If he'd just been able to go with that particular flow, eventually he would never have known the difference between having adventures with just all boys and having adventures with a mixed band of boys and girls. Perhaps that was too mature a viewpoint for the kind of boy he was. And perhaps an invisible line had been crossed when Wendy had played mother. The denial for the need of a mother had been erased, you see, and there was no going back. And poor Peter just couldn't readjust his perception of what a mother was. Mothers didn't fight pirates. They didn't go on the warpath with Indians. They didn't have their own bows and arrows. Ho, ho, ho. What I could have told him about that from my visits to the real world. Yes, I visited there more often after Wendy's granddaughter. I knew I had some catching up to do. And yes, I did find Wendy on one of those visits. She was a very old woman by then. I found her in Kensington Gardens, and what do you suppose she was doing? Letting children out of their prams. Yes, and only girl children. Oh, I know they don't call them prams anymore, but you know what I mean. No one really knew what she was doing, and none of the children ever got far before their mothers caught them again. She was dotty, I decided, as I lured her to a secluded area and revealed myself. "Hello, Tink," she said. "Do you still hate me?" "I never really hated you," I told her, "but you must realize that what you did wasn't right." She gave a sigh that shook her body alarmingly. "Just a bundle of sticks now, Aunt Wendy. I was glad Peter wasn't here." Of course I understand, she said. Why do you think I'm letting the little girls loose? They're entitled to a childhood full of adventures and excitement, not just training for an adulthood of nothing but limitations. She laughed sadly. Yes, Tink, I've learned. That's part of growing up, you see, to learn some of your lessons too late. I'm trying to make amends, but it's hard. People watch their children so much more closely than they used to. I don't think a child's been lost to the fairies here in over 30 years. And there are so few of them. They're all shut up tight in daycare centers and schools. Peter is lucky to get any of them at all, boys or girls. She paused, looking alarmed. Does he still get to them, Tink? Or has the worst happened? Obviously, she hadn't seen her granddaughter lately, which made me feel very sad for her indeed. I was about to tell her all about that when a police officer came along, rendering me invisible. All she found was a dotty old woman talking to some hydrangea bushes, and she led her away, still talking. That made me feel very, very sad. Poor Wendy, a stereotype to the end. You can see it coming, can't you? Anybody can, except Peter and some of the more obtuse boys. She rebelled completely, of course. The first night in the underground house, she crept up to my chamber, took some fairy dust, and flew out into the darkness. She was back the next morning with her own band, and needless to say, they were all girls. They set up camp in Mermaid Lagoon and waited for the pirates to attack. Hook, who had been burned before and hadn't forgotten it, held off and had a few half-hearted skirmishes with Peter and his band instead. The girls got tired of waiting, and in a brilliant midnight raid, attacked the Jolly Roger and took it over, forcing all the pirates to walk the plank. They sailed around in it for weeks until they lost interest and went ashore. Hook and his men saved it from going aground, refitted it, and declared war. What excitement! What action! Sometimes the girls would win, sometimes the pirates would beat them back. But even when the pirates won, they knew they'd been in a fight, I can tell you. Hook lived in mortal fear that the lost girls and the lost boys would join forces and completely overwhelm him and his men. Do I have to tell you that that never happened? Peter and his boys had a very disappointing season. It rained every other day, and they ended up hanging around the underground house, bored out of their minds. So much so that some of the new boys started talking about something called video games and television. That was what Peter had tried to tell me. That was when Peter had tried to tell me we were doing fine, providing childhoods for those who would otherwise have been forced to unfortunate precocity. While on the other side of the island, the girls had made a treaty with the Indians and were whooping it up like mad. When it finally occurred to Peter that he hadn't seen Tiger Lily in many, many moons, his dismay was terrible to behold. And when he crept up to the Indian village and found Wendy's granddaughter and Tiger Lily smoking the peace pipe together and leading the dance around the campfire without him, I thought he would die of heartbreak. He could not get over that one, of course, and it was what drove him to ask her for a meeting. I carried the message to her naturally. "Well, well," she said to me, "so as Nibs has finally decided to parley, eh? What do you say, girls? Shall I talk with our boy Pan, or shall we attack the pirates again?" They all voted for the pirates, but she was just being difficult. She agreed to meet him in Mermaid Lagoon. It didn't go well. Peter swaggered up to her and said brightly, "Well, time to go home and grow up. The boys are ready. How about you?" She poked him in the chest with her finger. "You can keep that stuff, pal. No, all the boys go home and grow up. You don't go home and grow up, so who says we have to? Maybe some of my girls want to, and if they do, I won't stop 'em. But me, I like it here. I'm planning to stay a good long time, maybe forever and ever. I like showing Hook who's boss. I like dancing around the campfire with Tiger Lily and the rest of the Indians. And I like flying." Peter gave me a dirty look. He knew I'd been supplying her as well as him. "But what could I do? If you're a child in Never Neverland, you get the dust. It's the law." "The pirates could have it if they wanted, but it won't work for them because they can't think good thoughts. And the Indians have their own way of life." They argued and argued, but Peter couldn't get her to budge. In the end, some of the boys left, but not one of the girls. And when Peter went out to collect some more children the next season, he couldn't find one girl to be mother. They'd all gone with her. She stayed and stayed and stayed until it was obvious that she was never going to leave the island. No one knew what to call her. Pammy Pan? Patty Pan? Petra Pan? She settled on Elspeth. Heaven knows why, I don't. And for a long, long time, it was the Lost Boys with Peter and Lost Girls with Elspeth, and never the twain would meet. And then, of course, it happened. The morning dawned when there were both girls and boys with Elspeth, and only boys with Peter. Nothing I could do, Tink, Elspeth told me. I've been taking their sisters away for years, and the sisters had been telling them stories, and they wanted in on the fun. Sure, I said no at first. Then I realized how unfair it was. After all, Peter's been doing just that very thing with the girls. That's how I got started in the first place. It's ridiculous to have the boys only with boys and girls only with girls. It's not how anyone lives. Oh, the pirates are all male, but they're pirates. You don't expect pirates to be enlightened. I had a feeling the pirates' day was coming. But they weren't my concern. They could take care of themselves. Couldn't you just combine the bands, I said, lost girls and lost boys together? Only if I or one of the other girls will be the mother, Elspeth said grimly. And we won't do it. We won't. If Peter can be stubborn, we can be just as stubborn. And there it sits. Peter on one side of the island with his little band, and Elspeth on her side with her somewhat larger band. What's really sad is that Peter's band gets smaller every year. Going with Elspeth has so much more to offer. She gets all the good fights with the pirates and all the good parties with the Indians, and she's even usurped Peter's drowning scene on the rock. Peter mopes around and cuts himself whittling a lot. Occasionally, a boy goes over to Elspeth, and that rains for a week on Peter's side. I guess what it is really is that eternal childhood is, well, not a lie exactly, but a half-truth. At some point, perhaps the very point at which a child is ready for Never Never Land, childhood is actually more of a choice than a condition. Elspeth chose. Peter could choose, too, but so far he won't. I think because he's so afraid that doing such a thing will mean he's growing up, and it won't mean any such thing at all. And there's the whole difference between childhood and childish. I shouldn't try to be an expert because I am, after all, a fairy. And as I said, it's all magic with fairies. Magic and no worries, unless you drink poison. And believe me, I'm not stupid enough to try that twice. Not the way things are today. Sometimes I wonder, though, what would happen. If my life depended on somebody's faith, whose faith would save me? Is Peter still strong enough? Does he still believe all those little children out there in the dark believe? After all that's happened, I like to think that's still so. I like to think that that's what keeps Peter the eternal boy he is, and that someday he'll go over to the other side of the island and hail Elspeth as his ally and friend, forget this silly mother business once and for all. It's not like he's got anything to lose. And then he'll really be himself again. He'll go back to being brave Peter Pan, the boy who won't grow up, instead of poor Peter, the boy that the children hardly ever fly with anymore. Thank you. Let me gather up my...
again. When I'm gone, I'm too old for dreaming.
And Wendy cried, "If only I could go with you."
You see, you can't fly.
And as Wendy waved farewell, Jane has waved farewell. And it's Jane's child now who waves from the window, enthralled to the breath of the night sky, where her child is flying, gay and innocent and heartless.
You have been listening to Pat Cadigan from nearly 30 years ago, reading her short story, The Lost Girls. And the music you heard was from the Broadway cast album of the Mabu Minds show, Peter and Wendy. And don't forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting give2wbai.org. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next Saturday morning at 7 a.m. In the meantime, stay tuned for David Rothenberg with Any Saturday. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please, stay tuned.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
This Saturday, a special May Day episode of Working Class Heroes. Across the country, companies are claiming that workers like deliveristas and taxi drivers are independent contractors, not employees. It's a legal trick designed to stop mostly immigrant workers' legal protections, covering wages, hours, and health and safety. But we'll be talking to restaurant delivery workers who are organizing to make sure that employers don't get away with this blatant attack on labor rights. So tune in this Saturday, May 1st, May Day, at 1 p.m. for Deliveristas of the World Unite on New York's home for community radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM, and online at WBAI.org.
Tune in to the WBAI Playhouse, Saturday, May 1st at 7 p.m. for the Obie Award-winning Metropolitan Playhouse as they present Charles Foster's melodrama, Bertha, the Sewing Machine Girl. She yearns for more opportunity and money elsewhere, but not without her father's consent and her withheld wages. But fate and some people in her life have some other ideas for Bertha, and her only hope may be a drunken wastrel whose life she must turn around if she hopes to get out of the sweatshop, stay out of prison, and keep out of wedlock. The popularity of this play, written in 1906 and later adapted into a film in 1926, attests to the enduring appeal of the sincere, if broad, renderings of human conflicts and aspirations, as well as the essential truths at the play's heart. The just are bedeviled by the selfish, the fortunate by the resentful, the powerless by the powerful, and chance plays a far greater role into our day-to-day than we wish. At this moment of serious inquiry into social inequities, Bertha, the Sewing Machine Girl, speaks more clearly and truthfully than it has for years. The Obie Award-winning Metropolitan Playhouse has been finding America one play at a time since 1993. Please tune in Saturday at 7 p.m. on 99.5 WBAI or streaming at WBAI.org.
Arise, you workers, from your slumber. All you wage slaves, everyone.
Mayday. Rise up and resist Saturday, May 1st, 9 p.m. to midnight. Where? Building bridges. Hear the voices of the multiracial working class and how we can combat the robber barons of new and empower we the workers. Always putting the issues of racial justice in the front line of the fight to bring about a true democracy. May Day, International Workers' Day, is a time to honor and celebrate the radical traditions of the labor movement. Now is the time to build on that militant legacy. For we have nothing to lose but our chance and the world to win. We're building bridges. May Day, Saturday, May 1st from 9 p.m. to midnight.
Extinction Diaries. A Yale study confirms that a mass extinction 66 million years ago included a steep drop in ocean pH levels, a clear sign the oceans were high in acidity, just like today. By studying the fossil remains of ancient plankton, scientists determined these and other marine animals with shells and skeletons from calcium carbonate were disproportionately wiped out in that extinction. The study suggests higher ocean acidity prevented these calcifiers from creating their shells. This means the first level of the ocean food chain, supporting the rest of the ecosystem, collapsed and triggered the mass extinction. Acidity in today's oceans have not been this high since tens of millions of years before modern man. Our civilization is adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and the oceans are absorbing that, raising the acidity. Today's coral, shellfish, and species like shrimp, crabs, and lobster are already wearing down their shells. Oddly, we recognize the consequences, but continue to fail to fix the problem. My name is Arne Olivier.